or just children of God? What, who were they like?
Well, I don't know if anybody knows for sure, and there are two theories. One is that the sons of God who married human women were angels, and that the Nephilim, or the giants, some people believe were the products of those marriages. Another view is that the sons of God were human beings. Sometimes in the Bible, human beings are called sons of God. For example, in John 1:12, where it says, as many as received him, to them he gave the power to become the sons of God, even to as many as believed on his name. So anyone might be a son of God if they're a godly person and belong to God. Some people believe the sons of God, there are simply godly people, godly men, who married women who were not so godly. And on that view, the giants or the Nephilim were not reproduced from those marriages. That is, the Nephilim existed independently and are only mentioned independently of these marriages. They're not the products of the marriages.
Okay, it calls them heroes of old. When I read it, I interpreted it like angels, and these were perhaps angelic creatures that were before Adam and Eve. Is that a possibility?
Well, this is not before Adam and Eve. This is describing events that happened just before the flood of Noah, which was at least 1,500 years after Adam and Eve's time.
What is it referring to when it calls heroes of old?
Well, we only have those words. We don't have any further elaboration on them. We have some idea of what heroes means. Of old means of, from old time. So these people became, I guess, champions in their own day. They became heroes, people perhaps who did great deeds in battle.
When it says heroes of old, I'm interpreting that as heroes of old for that time. For, like, it's not just now, but for that time, they were like heroes of old. Am I out of line, or?
Well, I suppose one could take it that way if they wish. It's not very intuitive to take it that way. I don't think that'd be the most natural way to understand the words. Sometimes clauses can be intended in a way that's not the most natural way to see them. But I think the easier way to look at this is to say that the writer is saying, from his point of view, these were heroes of old, that is, old days before the flood. If you want to take it the other way, I don't suppose it'll change very much in the way we live our lives.
Okay. Awesome. Well, I really appreciate your time. I really enjoyed my conversation, and I appreciate you answering all the questions. I appreciate all you're doing. God bless you. Okay. Take care of yourself.
Thanks, Gabriel. God bless you. All right. Let's talk to Tom from Portland, Oregon. Tom, hi.
Yes, hello. Hey, it's interesting you were mentioning Tozer. I've read a lot of his works, and kind of keys into my question for you today, which is the subject of renunciation. One of the things that Tozer seems to repeat many times in his books is the blessedness of renunciation, meaning that one of the problems he saw with many Christians in his era was too many things.
Mm-hmm.
Many material things which were clouding and creating their sense of lacking spirituality. So he would many times advocate less is better. My question is, could this be true today with American Christianity, is that we become so obsessed with things, the malls, the material things, the new cars, competing with our neighbors for this and that, that we actually have, in a sense, shot ourselves in the foot by robbing ourselves of untold spiritual blessings, which are there but cannot be seen because we have our own spiritual blessings bank account. If God can't meet it, well, we'll just go out and charge it, you know. And we don't really give ourselves the opportunity to see how the Lord can provide because we are too busy, well, like the lady you called earlier about prayer. Well, I'll give the Lord 2 or 3 days and answer my prayer. If he doesn't, well, I can always do it myself, you know. And I noticed in Tozer's writings, he spent a bit of time on this, on some of his books, about how that in the school of renunciation, many of the great blessings of Christianity are to be discovered. I just thought I'd ask you a question. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think particularly of the chapter in Tozer's book, The Pursuit of God, which is called The Blessedness of Owning Nothing or of Possessing Nothing. And that certainly is a chapter about renunciation, but you're right, it comes up in some of the shorter treatments of things too. What is renunciation? I guess that's what people need to figure out. I believe renunciation is the same concept as what Jesus had in mind when he said that you must forsake all that you have to be his disciple. That's in Luke 14:33, I believe. He says, unless you forsake all that you have, you cannot be my disciple. Well, lots of people think forsaking, it means you literally walk away from it. And it could mean that. But I believe he's talking about renouncing it. And renouncing it means to disown it. That means you transfer title of it. You say, this is not mine. To renounce something is to say, this is not mine. I forsake the ownership of it. I renounce my possession of it. Now, that can mean that you actually divest yourself of the thing you're renouncing or that you're disowning. It may mean that you actually liquidate things. It also might mean that although God wants you to keep those things and use them for him, they are in your true heart of hearts no longer yours. They are his. And, you know, I think a lot of Christians would say, well, everything I have is the Lord's. It's a real cliche kind of thing to say, but let him try to get any of it from you. You know, if really you've renounced everything, then you can't complain if God takes anything from you. That is the way you know if you've forsaken it in your heart, if you've disowned it, if you've transferred the title of all that you have, not just your stuff, of everything that's of value to you. I mean, think of Abraham, who had to renounce his homeland. And he had to leave, he was told to leave his father and his family and his homeland and everything familiar and go to a place he'd never been before. So he went. And then he had to forsake his father and the other members of his family in Haran. And then eventually he had to forsake Ishmael, his firstborn son. He had to send him off. And then later God wanted him to sacrifice Isaac, his most beloved son. God stopped him from doing it, but only after Abram had made it very clear that he was willing to do that. He was seeing that Isaac was not his to keep. He was God's. And I think that God may test us in this to see, you know, if we in our own hearts still own things, our family, our stuff, our own lives also. Those are the things that need to be renounced. Those are things that need to be disowned. It doesn't mean we get rid of them. It means we recognize they don't belong to us. They belong to God. We may be managing them. We may be required by God to use them for his purposes to bring profit to his kingdom. That's what a steward does. But a steward, by definition, is using somebody else's things. He may be the manager of a store that he doesn't own. And he makes transactions with vendors. He hires help and fires people. He decides when he's going to run a sale or a promotion of some kind. And he may do this all on his own initiative. He may be given the authority to do all that because he's the manager and he's been given that stewardship. But he doesn't own the store. He's trying to make it profitable for the owner. Of course, it will go well for the manager if the owner succeeds. But the main thing is that the owner is the one who makes the profit ultimately from the increased sales. So the manager is really working for the owner's interests, his own secondarily, but he's going to benefit if the owner's interests are advanced. And that's what a steward is, someone who's got somebody else's stuff to manage for that somebody else's interests. So when you look at the money in your bank account, you look at the stuff in your house, you look at the people in your house, you look at your opportunities, your free time, all of these are things that don't belong to you. Renunciation means you give those all over to God. It doesn't mean you become excessively religious, because religion and God aren't the same thing. It may mean that you become excessively loving to people and generous to people and servant-minded to people. But the point is, all that you have is God's and you're a steward of it. And until you renounce it in your own heart, until you disown it, until you say, this is no longer mine and I will no longer think and act as if it were, you cannot be a disciple. And I think that that's what probably Tozer and others are talking about when they talk about
renunciation. Tom, I appreciate your call. Okay, let's talk to Linda from Kenmore, Washington. Linda, welcome to The Narrow Path. Good to hear from you again.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I have a follow-up question to your first question of today. Why did God seek advice on how he was going to get Ahab into trouble?
Well,
I mean, I don't think he really needed it.
Right. He doesn't need advice. But, you know, there could be some anthropomorphism there in that vision. That is the way it's related, that God is likened to a man. You find God asking questions of people as if he didn't know the answers a lot of times in the Bible. Like he says, after Adam and Eve sinned, he said, Adam, where are you? You know, and Adam says, I'm here in the bushes. He said, well, what are you doing in the bushes? Who said you were naked? Did you eat that fruit by any chance? You know, I mean, like, God doesn't know. And later when Cain kills Abel, God says to Cain, hey, where's your brother anyway? You know, he says, well, I don't know. And God says, no, you do. I do, too. You know, his blood cries to me from the ground. A lot of times God communicates with people as if he's not all-knowing when we know he really is. I mean, in Genesis 18, God said that he was going to go down to Sodom and see if it was as bad as he'd heard down there. You know, he said to Abram, he said, the report of Sodom has come to my ears, and I'm going down there to see if it's as bad as I've heard it is. And if it is, I'll know. Now, how could God need to make a physical trip to Sodom to know what's going on there? You know, obviously, this is anthropomorphic writing. This is God taking a human-like form and talking to people as if he's on their level when he's really not. Perhaps to avoid being overly intimidating. Also, in the visions of God, you know, in Isaiah chapter 6, Isaiah sees the Lord high and lifted up, and the Lord says, who will go for us? You know, like he doesn't know. And Isaiah says, here am I, send me. So, you know, I think that we have, in many cases, God described, you know, in a human-like way without trying to indicate that he really has the human-like limitations that that would be suggested if we took it too literally.
Okay. That's kind of the sense I had, but I wondered if there was any more detailed explanation that you might have. But
well, I mean, it does give the impression that God takes the angels into his counsel, you know. And if so, he may do so for the same reason that he takes humans into his counsel. You know, he gave humans the dignity of having dominion over the things that he'd created. That was something that he did to include us in the family, more or less. And it's possible that the angels have, you know, we don't know much about when the angels were created or why, but it may be that God has, you know, his own purposes for bringing the angels in on stuff with him, too. Of course, he remains their Lord, and they have to do what he says, but he, just as he allows us to pray, and then he'll respond to our prayers, although he knows better than we do what to do, he wants to include us in the process. So it may be similar with him and the angels.
Mm. Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Linda, good talking to you.
You too. Bye.
Bye now. Let's talk to James from Las Vegas, Nevada. James, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, Steve, I was just listening in on the previous caller, I mean the one before, about the accuracy of the copying of the scriptures. And you had brought up about the, well, some people are the King James only.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about, well, the forerunners of the King James is like the Wycliffe and the Tyndale Bibles.
Yeah.
And my question was, well, you know, it came from the Vulgate to the, I don't know which came first, the Tyndale or the Wycliffe, but how well received was the King James Version when it came out?
Well, I honestly don't know exactly how quick it was to catch on. Obviously, it became the standard Bible in English. I don't know if it took some decades or if people accepted it immediately. I don't remember the specific history of it. What's your reason for asking?
Well, I was talking about it's just like the the person that's got the bigger house than the other one, always looking down the hill at the other one, whereas the people with the King James only are looking down at my new King James and saying it's not as good.
Uh-huh.
But then there was probably a time when people had the Wycliffe or Tyndale Bible were looking down on them.
Well, yeah, I mean, what's wrong with Wycliffe's Bible? Why do we need a King James Version now? You know?
Yes, right. Uh-huh.
Well, yeah, I really don't know if people were being that critical of versions of the Bible back then. I think there was an improvement in many of these versions in that, you know, one would be working strictly from the Vulgate. That is, it would be a translation directly from the Latin. But the Latin's not the original. It itself is a translation from, you know, the earlier Greek. I think the King James was, if I'm not mistaken, not the King James as we have it, but an earlier version of the King James. It's been through many revisions. But the original King James, if I'm not mistaken, and my history is a little foggy on this, I think it was the first time the Old and New Testament were both translated into English from the original languages as opposed to some of it from Latin. I may be wrong about that. The King James, of course, went through how many revisions? 5 or 6 or something like that before it became like the one we have now. It's always seemed strange to me that someone would pick out a particular stage of the development of the English text, the 1611, you know, and say that's when the perfect translation was made, and all the revisions before it, all the revisions after it, somehow they're just not any good. This one is the one, and I think it seems kind of arbitrary to me, but I believe it's the result of people wanting to have what they would call a perfect Bible, meaning a perfect translation of the Bible, and they were raised with the King James. They're familiar with it. They've been taught, you know, when they quoted from the King James, that's the Word of God. And then someone comes along, lo and behold, and modernizes the English and changes a few things because of new manuscript discoveries. And suddenly they're threatened. They say, wait a minute, my perfect Bible has been changed. And instead of saying, well, the Bible as I've been reading it was changed many times to come to this point, maybe these changes are be improvements too. I think it's commitment to the status quo and fear of change that causes people to take that rather superstitious approach to the King James Version, I think.
Well, I think all in all, we ought to be thankful for the fact that the other alternative would be that the Catholic Church would rather remain illiterate and not be able to read it at all.
Yeah, it's wonderful that the Bible was given to us in English, because if it hadn't been, we'd still be trusting the priests to teach us in Latin, and we wouldn't know what it says. King James is a great Bible. It's just not without flaws, and it can be improved on in some of its readings. That's been proven from manuscripts. I mean, even using the same manuscripts that the King James used, there are some places where the King James didn't translate it very well. I mean, a classic example is John 14:1-2, where Jesus said, "In my Father's house are many mansions." The King James says mansions, but the word in the Greek doesn't have any relationship to mansions. It just means a dwelling place. So how do you get the idea of a mansion out of a mere word that means in Greek a dwelling place? And we know that it doesn't mean mansion, because the same word is translated in the King James 21 verses later, translated as home. So you've got the word translated mansions and the same word translated home, both in the King James. Which one is right? I mean, I live in a home, but I don't live in a mansion. So, what is the correct range of meaning of that word? The King James doesn't even agree with itself on that. So, I mean, even using the manuscripts that they used, if someone says, well, the Textus Receptus used by the King James, that's the better manuscript. Okay, go with it. But you can still improve on the translation. You don't have to translate Monet as mansion. In fact, you shouldn't, because it doesn't mean that. There are issues in the King James that can be improved on and have been improved on in modern translations.
Well, I think Peter had it right when he says he can move out of this mortal tent and move into a better place.
Yeah, we will. We will.
Okay, Steve, I really appreciate your input on that.
Okay, James, thanks for your call.
Let's talk to Mary from Irvine before we run out of time here. Hi, Mary. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
Good. Thank you.
My question is, if in a relationship between man and a woman, if man cheats and they have no regret of what they have done, how does that work as far as heard of word karma? In the universe, apart from the God, in the universe, whatever you do to some mean to somebody, it will come back to you to bite you. And if you do good to somebody, it will come back to reward you. So how does that compares to religion as far as the karma? I've heard it's not true because, how can I explain? It's not true because there's so much mean things people do in the world. So many countries have bad leaders, and they do kill their people. They do all kinds of bad things to the people. Mm-hmm. Nothing happens to them, and they just continue living on.
I'll tell you what it is. There are different religious ideas about how the score will be settled. Obviously, in this life, there is no settlement that is just. I mean, there occasionally is, but many things are left unsettled, as you mentioned. There are tyrants who murder, you know, millions of people, and then they die rather suddenly without much suffering. Like, say, Saddam Hussein or Adolf Hitler, someone like that. You know, they weren't tortured or didn't have a prolonged period of dying miserably. They caused other people to die miserably, but they got to die rather suddenly when they died. And that doesn't seem very fair. Or, like you said, a woman whose husband cheats on her and she's been faithful to him and he's not regretting it and he's, you know, making her life miserable by his lack of faithfulness. He may not ever be punished for it in this life. So the question is there no justice at all in the universe since people can do bad things and die comfortably and other people can be very good people and live poor and miserable and persecuted and tortured lives and die prolonged agonizing deaths? I mean, it just doesn't seem fair, and it isn't. Sadly, life is not fair, but the question is, how does that get settled? Now, there's two different ways that different religions have seen it. There's what we might call Western and Eastern religion, two different types. Western religion, usually, is monotheistic, and the belief is that there is a God who will, in fact, judge everybody and settle the scores. And nobody gets away with anything. Paul said, do not be deceived. God is not mocked. What a man sows, he's going to reap. But he won't necessarily reap it in this life, but he'll reap it because God is the final score settler. He's going to judge everyone. Jesus said every idle word a man shall speak, he'll have to give account of it in the day of judgment. So there's going to be a very detailed judgment when Jesus returns and judges the wicked and the righteous. The righteous will be rewarded, the wicked will be punished as they deserve. So according to Western monotheism, there is justice, ultimately. It's just not seen in this present lifetime, but there's going to be another life. And in that life, the score will indeed be settled, and God will settle it. Now, the other view is that which is found in Eastern religion. Sometimes they believe there's many gods. Sometimes they don't. Buddhism, for example, doesn't necessarily believe there is a god. Buddha was atheistic. The Hindus believe there are millions of gods. They're not monotheistic religions. They don't believe that there's a God out there who settles the scores in the next life, but they do believe that the scores have to be settled. I mean, everybody knows that intuitively. One way or another, some justice has to come. For one thing, if there was no such thing as justice in reality, why would we all think there should be? I mean, why would a species evolve with a passion for justice if justice is something that doesn't even exist? It does exist. It's like imagining, you know, a creature being born with an appetite for a certain kind of food that never existed. It doesn't happen. All people cry out for justice. All people complain of injustice. And there is such a thing as justice. But the question is, how is it ever settled? Well, it's either going to be settled the way the Bible says, through God judging and settling scores,
which is, of course, what I believe. But the alternative would be the way Eastern religion says. You get to come back and do it again. And you get to come back and do it again. And the next life, the reincarnation thing, when you come back, you have to settle the karmic score. You have to settle the debt. You see, if you did more bad things than good things in your lifetime and didn't suffer much for them, then you die with a surplus of bad karma or bad credit, as it were. You got to come back and suffer. You got to come back and be more miserable in the next life to pay off that karmic debt. On the other hand, if you suffer a great deal but you don't do bad things, if you're a good person and you suffer and you die that way, well, then you've got a surplus of good karma. So the next time you come around, you have a little better situation. You'll be less suffering in the next situation. And this goes on reincarnation after reincarnation. So that, according to Hinduism, you might go through 100,000 lifetimes. And every time you do, there's a little bit of tweaking of this karmic debt that remains on your record. The Bible doesn't teach that. The Bible makes it very clear there is no karma. In fact, Jesus said, for example, blessed are you if you suffer for righteousness' sake or persecute for righteousness' sake. If karma is true, there's no suffering for righteousness' sake. You're only suffering because of bad things you did. You never suffer because you do the right thing. The Bible teaches a different doctrine than that. It's not karma. It's God. And God is going to judge and settle the scores. And that is something that all people who love justice can rejoice about. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. As I mentioned earlier, we are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us stay on the air where you're listening to us, you can write to this address. It's The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California. That's P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92591. You can also find that address or even donate, if you'd like, from our website, The Narrow Path. com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless.
Thanks for joining us today here on Memorial Day 2014 on AM 740 KBright. We hope you enjoyed this best of the best of The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Steve will be back with us live tomorrow, as we hope you will be with us as well. This is AM 740 KBright. Joyce Meyer is next.
Oh, I think this product is absolutely hands down one of the most amazing products that I've ever been associated with.
That's the owner of Pacific Coast Home Solutions, Eric Martinson, and what he's talking about is Supercoat, the lifetime guaranteed paint replacement that will never, ever crack, peel, or fade.
The average homeowner in California ends up having to paint their house somewhere between every 3 and 7 years, especially people on the coastline. You deal with the salt air, the fog, and the changing of temperatures. And that is devastating to paint because all that expansion and contraction really just makes the paint peel. Supercoat is a paint replacement enabling a homeowner to only have to paint their home one time and never have to paint it again. That is a huge savings going down the road.
And speaking of huge savings, Pacific Coast Home Solutions will show you how to get this top-of-the-line paint alternative for less than market value by paying for some of it with the manufacturer's money. Just call 888-802-0699 for more details. 888-802-0699. Pacific Coast Home Solutions. For home improvements, they help you pay for.
I have Supercoat on my home because I don't want to keep painting either.
Jesus said, "Greater love has no man than this, that he lay down his life for his friends." This is Pastor Rick Warren, and this Memorial Day, I urge all KBRT listeners to pause and thank God for those who made the ultimate sacrifice in preserving our freedom.
KBRT at KBRT HD Costa Mesa, and on the web at KBRT740.com.
Welcome to Enjoying Everyday Life with New York Times bestselling author Joyce Meyer. On today's program, Joyce will be teaching from her series entitled 9 Attitudes That Keep You Happy. Think back over the years and remember some of the major events that occurred. Are you remembering good times or bad? How did you respond in those moments? Generally, in good times, the response is well. But in bad, your attitude tends to be negative. It's amazing, though, how much your attitude can affect a situation. Today, Joyce will be teaching from Matthew chapter 5 on Jesus' Sermon on the Mount. Through it, you'll hear some of the different attitudes of the heart that Jesus desires you to have. Allow yourself to be open and see what attitudes you can change in your own heart. Now, here's Joyce with today's teaching, 9 Attitudes That Keep You Happy.
Well, are you ready for the Word?
Well, this weekend, I'm going to teach on the what I'm going to call the be happy attitudes. We all want to be happy, don't we? I'd say, really, if you just get right down to it, if you could just find the bottom line of what everybody wants, we really just want to be happy. We want to enjoy our life and be happy. And attitudes are very, very, very important. And I'm going to say something to you that you may not believe right up here going into this, but hopefully you'll get a little more convinced as the time goes by this weekend. I believe that really it's not our circumstances that make us so unhappy. Now, I'm not saying they're not unpleasant and that they're not difficult and they're not challenging, and certainly they have the ability to steal our joy if we let them. But I really don't believe it's our circumstances that make us unhappy. I think it's our attitude in our circumstances. Can anybody kind of go that far with me tonight? It's our attitude in our circumstances that really make us unhappy. You may have heard this quote before, but Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust victim, said that they may take everything away from me here, human dignity, food, every right that a human being should have, but one thing they cannot take away from me, and that's my decision to have a good attitude. And it's so true that if you will just, and I will just, make a decision that we're going to have a good attitude. And a good attitude means that you can even take a bad situation and say, you know, I don't like this situation, but I believe I'm going to get something out of it. I'm going to learn something. I'm going to grow through it. And this too will pass. It's going to be over. And how many of you know that after you come through difficult times, you usually are.